You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hey, hey, Launch Streeters, Tamara here, your host and big dog lover. Actually, when I say that, I mean like big dogs, not just dogs, big dogs. In fact, my 90-pound Mastiff is curled up next to me as I speak, and she's snoring, so hopefully you can't hear it. All right, this episode is brought to you by Brility Digital, who tackles incredibly tough business challenges from a strategic growth perspective in order to implement the most effective digital resources to meet your objectives. And as you know, I'm not interested in just any old sponsor, so I interview the founder, Derek Kuhn, partway through to give you some serious business insights. Now, we all have foes in business, right? The person or company that you are always up against. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Well, today was a real treat for me because I got to interview one of my foes from back in the day. How cool is that? When I was doing new product development consulting, we'd always go up against this company, Eureka Ranch. Always. Sometimes I won, sometimes I lost. And today I interview one of its founders, Doug Hall. He's the founder of Eureka Ranch, Innovation Engineering Institute, and Brain Brew Custom Whiskey. He's been named one of America's top innovation experts by Inc. Magazine, Wall Street Journal, Dateline NBC, CNBC, CIO Magazine, and CBC. His new book, Driving Eureka, Problem Solving with Data-Driven Methods and Innovation Engineering Systems, is on the shelves. So yeah, this was a real treat. We dig deep into innovation, maybe even geek out on it. So enjoy. Doug, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, I have to know, what's your favorite innovative brand or business, and why do you love it so much?
I think about this, I apologize in advance.
Uh-oh.
But it would be Paddle Wheel 200-year wood whiskey, which, full disclosure, is one of the products that I have this craft whiskey company, and we wanted to go back and create whiskey at the time of the riverboats because 80% of all the whiskey came from the Cincinnati area where we are, and we're celebrating it. And we took 200-year-old wood, and we made it, and it is like, bing! I mean, it's just mind-blowing. It's got a depth and a character to it, and at this moment in time, the absolute coolest product is to be able to take a time machine and take you back in time to taste whiskey at the time of the riverboats. I just think that's like so cool, and so it tastes so amazing.
I have to know, why the passion for going back to the riverboat days? Where did that even come from?
Well, so here's the bizarre thing. Our company is called Brain Brew. And we make whiskey in a time machine in like 40 minutes. We've accelerated the aging. And so we can make luxury spirits. I mean, like double gold medal winning spirits using it. And so I just think it's really cool to take this most modern cutting edge technology to take you back in time to taste the way it would have been there. There's just something really cool about that, to take current technology to take us back in time.
I love it. We always talk about technology is to move us forward, but you're using it to move us back, actually.
Well, bizarrely, I mean, sometimes I feel like, I mean, we jokingly call it a time machine because we're accelerating the aging, but we're actually using the time machine to go back in time. You know, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's just, okay, it's not like the cure for cancer, or it's not like serious, but it's really fun. And the taste is just, it has this, I mean, it's like a $200 whiskey.
Yeah.
And we sell it for $35.
Well, I look forward to trying it. I'm hoping it's in Colorado.
It's really cool. It's really cool. It's really cool.
Oh, my God. I love it. So I'm going to leap forward and talk about innovation, which you're very much an expert in, have years of experience in, as I mentioned in the intro. I want to start with a little bit of a different kind of a perspective on it, I guess, which is, how do most teams or organizations treat innovation like a risky gamble?
Well, first off, unlike finance and unlike their production processes and and most of their organizations, you know, they have discipline systems. But when it comes to innovation, it's usually just go figure it out. And there is not a discipline system. And just so that we're really clear, I'm not interested in creating ideas. The ideas are easy. What I'm interested in is ideas from idea to market. In other words, making them happen. And you know, usually it's just a random gamble. I mean, it's just like you figure it out, you make it up as you go along. And because it's new, they go, well, we don't really know. So you just kind of do it. And, you know, leadership gets engaged at the end, which is like the time when we don't need them. We need them at the front to help with the thinking. And so it is. It's just a randomness. This time they do it this way. This time they do it this way. There's no reliability. There's no reproducibility. There's no best practices. There's no operating system for doing. It's like the way cars were made in 1960. They were just kind of random. There was no discipline to the way they were. And you saw the quality we got. And guess what? The quality problem we had with cars in the 60s is the same as with innovation. Right now we have a 85 to 95% failure rate with innovations. I mean, it's as bad as an old Chevy plant. I mean, it's ridiculous. ridiculous.
Have you ever seen that book? I think it's How Did the Cadillac Get Its Wings? I think that's the name of the book. Have you seen it? And it talks about that, like why some of the things are the way they are. But it was talking about how the Cadillac has wings because people thought it looked fast. We all think it does something, but it doesn't. But the thing about the 60s cars just made me think about that because it was all the rage. But it really was like they threw something up on the wall and people were like, ooh, that goes fast. And they're like, well, let's do it then. I want to ask you about that. So about the lack of operating system. Why is that? Because if I go on to – I'm going to just throw in – this morning I was on LinkedIn and I saw all these LinkedIn ads for innovation processes, right, that are supposed to change the game. But do they work, and why don't we have an operating system for something that we know needs to be done continually?
Well, I think – I mean, it's similar to – I'm a chemical engineer and I worked in a paper mill back in the 70s, and quality was coming in from Dr. Deming's work in Japan. He came back over to the US to help with, he said 94% of the problem's the system, 6% is the worker. And the guys in the plant said, you know, I made this machine. It's an art. It can't be made of science. And I think we have that same misconception that innovation is something that happens with gurus who get in a lotus position on the top of the building and wait for the lightning to strike.
Yeah, it's magic.
And it's not. It's about working smarter, not harder. It's about thinking. And the systems are fine, but here's the key challenge with these systems. And this is where the mistake's been made. Systems are agnostic. They're not good, they're not bad. The question is the aim of the system. And most innovation systems, when they're put into an organization, are because we've had something that failed. And the systems are designed for control, not to enable. They're designed to prevent failure, which means they prevent everything, as opposed to a system like what I talk about in Driving Eureka is to enable a system to enable innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day, to enable innovation. That's a very different aim of a system. It's to encourage it, make it easier, make it smarter, make it faster, rather than stopping it.
It's interesting that you say that because I think some of the processes that are, you know, the trend of the year right now, the flavor of the month, are really aimed at making sure you don't forget a step versus, to your point, enabling. And I think, you know, innovation for everyone is near and dear to my heart. So let's talk about kind of in the book and
– Because you just sparked something.
Yeah.
And it's an insight that I've just recently – we came to about 6 months ago and it blew my mind. So when we do these things, we have checklists, and this book's a checklist and all this kind of stuff. And the problem is project management is built around a conformance to requirements.
Yeah.
You make a list of the requirements and you do the tasks. And that works fine when it's the, you know, 400th time you've done something.
Right. And but it's standard and mundane.
That's right.
Yeah.
But with innovation, there's uncertainties.
Yeah.
And so we ended up we had to build a software platform where you could have the things that are the simple tasks, but when there's an uncertainty, it allows you to go into cycles of learning or plan, do, study, act, rapid cycles of learning. And so it's like a standard system, but one that becomes unstandard when you hit an uncertainty. And that's a different type of project management. And when we apply classic project management to innovations where we, you know, it's like, I don't know how we're going to make that work,
right,
we blow up. And
right,
that conflict between the fact that we are doing something new versus we know it already is part of the challenge.
So maybe I'm glad you mentioned that. Maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but you know, the whole kind of the whole uncertainty around the process is particularly with innovation is so big. And I think those of us who do it a lot realize, recognize that and are more, let's call it just comfortable with it. How do you think about uncertainty and what that really means? Because I think truly if I asked 12 different people, different companies, kind of what their level of uncertainty or how they feel about uncertainty is, I'd get different definitions or different responses.
Okay. So I believe in using data to make decisions. And the thing about data is data, every measurement you have has variance in it. There's a plus and a minus to it. And when it deals with uncertainty, it's like I was just with a team yesterday and we were going through their project P&L and they had all these numbers. And I said, okay, those are the numbers, but what's the range on each of those numbers? I mean, that's your guess.
Right.
But what's the worst case, the best case for those different numbers? What's the uncertainty? And they start, well, it could be as low as this. It could be as low as this. This is our best guess. I said, okay, so you've got that one. So that one's got a real wide uncertainty. The next variable's got a small uncertainty. So I put it in our platform. We've got a thing that allows us to do what's called a Monte Carlo simulation. And I modeled the variation. And I said to them, I said, that uncertainty at this point is real. We can't wish it away. You truly have uncertainty. Now what you need to do, and I took them down to the bottom of the page and I said, now what you need to do is you need to look at those ones that have the greatest variance divided by the mean. Those are the ones that are things that are going to cause you to fail. They have the highest risk. So let's design an experiment to reduce that variation in the process. This is exactly the same as the Chevy plant. This is the same. Drive out variation in those numbers. Now, to the artsy people who like to do innovation, this is like, you know, their heads blow up because this is like statistics and math to do it. And it's not to control, but it's to enable us so that we win when we ship.
So
we don't lose.
Yeah, you said it kind of quickly, but I want to go back to it and dig in a little bit more about, okay, so we have this variance, this uncertainty. So let's create an experimentation to understand like what it's about and maybe even take out the uncertainty. And I think what I've seen over time is that experimentation and micro experiments doesn't have to be, you know, launching something is so important to innovation. Can you share an example of kind of a variance in experimentation and how that brought light to that thing?
Yeah. So you have to. So like when we make our whiskey, because of our speed, we do 72 whiskeys in 7 days. And we run those experiments and then we take it. Yes, I do, actually. I know. It's not like work.
Sounds
and,
amazing.
And then we take it to, oh, you learn to spit. Okay. You
have to spit. I don't know.
But every now and then you have to swallow. I mean, it's just one of those things. You know? Okay. Now that's ridiculous. Okay, yeah. So let's move on.
Reel it in, buddy.
So, I'm talking whiskey. And so you put this stuff together and you're able to do it and you test with consumers. So let me give you an example. A classic example is when you're creating a whiskey, are you creating a whiskey for the only 18% of Americans drink whiskey in the past 12 months? Mm. But there's about 50% that would like to drink whiskey, and it doesn't quite work.
Yeah.
So we had a project to get what we called the whiskey wannabes to get in.
So people like
and
me.
And so – yeah, who would like to have whiskey. They think they love the attitude towards it. Yeah. They love the cocktails, but they kind of bite. And you know. So we made this super smooth product, okay? Super smooth product. It's called Keel Boat. And so we made this product. But when we went into testing, you know, we would test it, and you'd have to look at how often they'd had whiskey. And sure enough, the whiskey people didn't like it. They didn't think it was very good. They said, it's pretty soft. You know, I like a bite of my whiskey. We take it to the other group, the whiskey wannabes, and they go, oh my God, this is the first time I've had a whiskey that I really love. Hmm. Well, unless you're doing that testing and you're looking at who's liking, and quantitative, by the way, not qualitative, statistical samples is where I'm about. Because the decisions are big decisions. They're important decisions. And if I have a bunch of people sitting in a room who are big whiskey drinkers, they go, ooh, it needs a little bit more leather, you know, old people.
In
you
that
know.
Voice.
I mean, they're of no value to me. I mean, it's interesting. I just ran the data. We're doing a thing tonight, a custom whiskey experience in cocktails. And I had the guys go and I say, I wonder what the percent alcohol is in these cocktails and the percent sugar in all the cocktails we do. Because we'd never done it. So we have this fancy piece of equipment and we ran all the cocktails. And I'm looking at the numbers and I'm like going, Oh my God. It's no wonder people segment into these groups, because there is a physiological difference in the amount of sugar and the amount of alcohol and the ratio of sugar to alcohol in these cocktails. And so they're building this cool model now, which allows us to ask you some questions, and we can literally diagnose how you should make the cocktail. It's the same cocktail, but you should make it differently for your tastes because there are patterns. Well, this is science in something that, I mean, it's cocktails. It's like art, you know, some numbnuts behind a bar doing it. But when we get in deep, that's how you drive out risk. And that's how you get your team pumped up, because we're looking at this data and we go, I said, how many people do you think have ever looked at this? They said, well, only people that have the $35,000 piece of equipment that we've got. And they're like, probably not many, you know? And that gets you jazzed. It gets the team excited. And the consumers tonight, when we show them this data, it's going to blow their brains, because they're going to go, I'm going to have them taste them. I go, so which ones do you like? Please. Okay, now let me show you why you like that. And now that you know that, let me guide you how you can take a cocktail. And don't make it the way your husband likes it this way, right. You want it this way, wife likes it this way. You can make the exact same cocktail differently and you can both love it.
So I want to, that's a great story. And I actually can't wait to hear what they say after you do the research. I want to back up and go a little bit high level for a second, because one of the reasons I thought having you on the podcast would be great was in your book, Driving Eureka, and in your work, right? You're all about data-driven innovation. And we spend, you know, there's this myth out there, and you alluded to it earlier, that innovation is for, you know, these select few, and it's magical and these aha moments, and it's this big blue skies, nobody's ever thought of it before things. And, you know, you got to have a purple streak in your hair to do it. But you're really about data-driven innovation. So talk about what that really is and why it is so important.
Well, because when you don't use data to make decisions, okay, and let's deal with the real decisions. The real decisions isn't at the front. It's in development. Yeah. That's where all the ideas die, okay? When the purple hair people are gone and, like, real people have to actually make the thing.
Right, right.
Okay? And so they end up and they figure out that they can't do this. They can't make metal do this. They can't make the software do this. It just doesn't work. And so they have to now make trade-offs. Or maybe the cost doesn't work. And when they make those trade-offs, sometimes in making those trade-offs, it doesn't impact the appeal of the idea. Sometimes it kills the idea. And so unless you can keep running tests, and the longer and more expensive it is to do a test, I mean, we can do a test for statistically reliable results. That's speed. That's the new technology. And so unless you have data to make it, you're making judgments and you make one thing, oh, that's not going to hurt it that much. Another thing, it's not going to hurt it that much. And the next thing you know, the idea is garbage. And that's why we have 95% failure. Where we need the innovation is in problem solving and development. The front end, give me any idea at the front. And if I've got a team that cycles, learns, pivots during development, I'll make it successful. So we need to have the engineers, the finance people. We need all of those people thinking, how can I go smarter? Because I tell you what, purple hair, that's beautiful, but do you know how to build it? Okay,
right,
can you
right.
make the tool?
Can you actually commercialize it?
Yeah. Can you do the math? I don't really care about your damn ideas. They're not, I mean, I've been doing this for 40 years, okay? So I'm an old fart. And I get so fed up at the front end when they say, I want you to dream big. I said, dream big, ship it, baby. I mean, I'm all for patentable breakthroughs, okay? I'll break technologies, we can do that. But you need to get purple hair, you need to understand the science a little bit more. Lofty thoughts are of no value to me.
Yeah,
you know, I'll just get some 8-year-olds can give me that, but that's not shipping, you know, and that's what Driving Eureka is about. It's about shipping. I mean, that's where we get $17 billion in ideas in active development right now. The largest collection of projects anywhere in the world, $17 billion. We've got over 24,000 innovations we've tested. I mean, we're talking not no, let's try a few tests. I'm talking like real data that drives out risk.
Yeah. I love that, because I do think we, you know, buy into this myth of magic and certain people. And it's funny. One of the things when I keynote, I talk about is not thinking outside the box, but rearranging the box you have. Because, you know, the purple haired people go outside the box and then there's no reality attached to it, to your point. And then everybody else gets involved and it's not possible.
Yeah. And I had a group yesterday, and part of the key, and you'll appreciate this. I had a group of executives and I said, how many of you have gone from creating an idea all the way through to shipping it? The whole process, front to back. One hand out of 20
wow.
went up. So if you've not lived, see, that's what happens when you become an old fart. when you've lived through these things and you've seen what happens as you go through the process, because the purple hair are gone. They said, I did my genius inspiration. Yeah. You know, it's in the doing that matters. And it's the mindset of creativity that you need through that process. Because if you haven't gone front to back at least a couple of dozen times, you're an amateur.
Yeah.
You're an amateur.
Well, and you really don't know what it takes to make an idea happen. You know, everything is possible. And it turns out some things are possible. So you got to figure out how do you stay innovative within those constraints. And then how do you innovate along the way as you learn. And that's the part where I think we forget to innovate.
And you got to make money.
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
You know, I really love a Lamborghini. I think it would be wonderful to have. But the math doesn't work.
Right.
You know?
So that's my problem.
Show me the math.
Right. In a random way, this segues into kind of what I want to ask you about next, because this is something that's very near and dear to my heart. We're at Launch Street all about everyday innovation and everyday innovators, and then it's not a department. And in fact, I had a woman – you'll get this. I had a woman come up to me. She had a major global law firm, and she said, hey, I want to ask you a question. My law firm just created an innovation team. There's 10 of them, and they're responsible for innovation. And then once a quarter, they report to us and tell us what we're going to do. What do you think about that? And, you know, I think you can imagine my response, but, you know, you're for, it shouldn't be a department, like she was saying. I mean, it broke my heart, really, is what it did, because I thought, oh, well, it's so sad, but you're for everyone, right?
So they deserve the 1960 Chevy.
Right.
When there was a department that did it versus it was part of everybody.
Totally.
I mean, let's put it this way. Okay, I want a few people to think smart, and I want everybody else to be an idiot and just do the same stupid stuff you've always been doing.
Right.
I mean, that's my job. Okay, so there's the cool kids, and then there's going to be the boring
and
people.
And you don't get to do anything because the other people get to do it. So you just keep your head down.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And that is a mistake. And because we just don't embrace this concept of never-ending innovation. How can I do it smarter? How can I do it smarter? How can I find a better way to do this? And interesting, when you talk about departments and people, Kevin Cahill, in the Driving Eureka book, I've got Kevin Cahill, the grandson of Dr. W. Edwards Deming, the icon. I'll be staying at his house week after next. We're going up to see him. And he said, I said, what do you do when leadership doesn't get it, when management doesn't get it? He said, the only thing you can do is you can't whine about it because the people are suffering. And so what we did is we turned our online course, our fundamentals course, to be, but just the hell with the boss. I'm going to help you in your sphere of influence. How can we teach you reliable systems for you to be able to work smarter, faster, more creatively in the work that's your work that you have control over? And that was liberating. It was liberating because we spent so much time whining that the boss isn't helping. Well, the boss doesn't know squat. How about if you make your life better now, right now?
And what I really appreciate about what you're saying, Doug, is the fact that it's what's right in front of you, right? You have work to do. So how do you think creatively about the work right in front of you?
Absolutely. Right now. Just get started.
Yeah, it's so great. And for launch readers out there listening, I really want you to think about how you can apply it to your everyday work. I mean, you've heard me say it time and time again, and I think what Doug here is saying is so powerful, both in the sense of it's for everyone, and second, I'm going to layer on what you were talking about earlier about it being data-driven. I think sometimes passion is great and it's important, but I think sometimes it gets in the way of making actually smart decisions. So...
Well, so what I believe in is you have to separate. When I'm talking to entrepreneurs and, you know, because we make money on big companies and we give away a lot of stuff to small companies and entrepreneurs and really kind of this Robin Hood thing. And they'll talk about their idea and they'll talk about their idea. I says, what's the mission? Why are you doing this? What are you trying to do? And let's separate the mission from the idea. The ideas are flexible. We'll just change the idea, you know, just pivot, change. But they fall in love with the idea instead of the mission. What are you trying to accomplish in your life? What are you trying to do? Okay. Give me what you want to do. And then let's figure out, because the idea should change. And when you're in love with the idea and you don't have a mission to it, that's when you get all messed up.
Yeah.
That's
and you get blinded. You get blinded by whatever it is that you love about that idea instead of where you're actually headed.
That's right. Absolutely.
I want to ask you a question about, I read this somewhere. I think it might have even been an article about developing stimulus for your team that taps both the left and the right brain. So talk a little bit about that. How do you do that?
So we believe in stimulus diversity, driving out fear through experimentation. That's what the data, 6,000 teams measured, shows. Ideas are combinations of things, but you have to get both the left and right brain together. Because remember, we're not talking about art. We're talking about ideas that can ship. And so whether if it's left brain doing patent mining, I mean, there's millions of recipes for how to do stuff that are in the public domain that are wonderful inspiration sources for ideas. There's academic articles. At the same time, future mining, what if scenarios and unrelated things that just provoke your brain, those work too. And the answer is not or, it's and. And we need to bring all of these together. And that's why diversity is not additive. It's not multiplicative. It's an exponential increase in our impact when we get people who are totally different from us. I mean, and sadly, this country has lost that concept because we have these monocultures that want to stay one way, which is just inanely stupid. It's totally incompetent, and it's the dumbest thing in the entire world. But they love to keep tribal. I guess we're just going to be tribes from now on, as opposed to this incredible salad bowl that made this country so wonderful.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, I mean, it's probably a whole different podcast, but our identities have become wrapped up in that one element of that one tribe. Which makes it even worse, because then we're claiming as one-dimensional human beings, not as the dynamic people that we could be. So there's so many issues on that note. I was thinking back to a meeting I was in. I actually wasn't running this meeting. It was a brainstorm meeting for ideation. It was the front end. We were trying to solve a gap in the marketplace. And I never forget thinking, there were, I don't know, 12 of us in the room, and 6 of us were chatty. I mean, I'm an extrovert. I will suck up all the air in the room if I have the opportunity. And 6 weren't, let's call it, weren't participating. At least that's the perception. But I, you know, looking back at the exercises, which were all group conversation, what the facilitator really wasn't doing was tapping everybody in different ways. There was no diversity in the stimulus. And I think we've all been in those kind of meetings where, like, it works for some people and not for others. And what I hear you saying is, you know, find different stimulus for different parts of the brain. And I think in doing that, you're going to tap different ideas, which is important, but also different types of people.
So you're really observant. And so it's not just stimulus, but it's method. So let me give you a very simple example of a way to do this.
Yeah.
That introvert has a lot of ideas in there, but yeah. There's no space for them to say that.
Right, because people like me suck up all the air.
That's true. You said it.
Yeah, I own it.
So we created a technique after a lot of experimentation, because we measure it and we measure the effect and we improve quality control charting of creativity. Yes, yes, yes. Of course you can. And so we came up with a thing called idea engineering. What we have people do is they take some individual, they do thinking as an individual. So you give them a challenge, a provocation, and they write down some first thoughts. Then they get in a pair with someone else, and they talk their thoughts to the other. So now it's a safe conversation of two people. I talk to you, you talk to me, we help each other.
But we started then solo, we go right? Back.
Started solo, okay. We did it in a pair, which is comfortable, and then we come back to the group, and rather than having the group create ideas, we keep the locus of control of the idea. So I come to the group and I say, well, here's my idea, and I'm not asking you if you like it or not, because I don't really care, it's my idea. But I need help with this. And the group then is helping me solve my problem. And it is 7 times more effective than classic brain draining is what Andy V. Gundy's research says. 7 times more big ideas because of it. Because we're now getting all of the brains of those people in a way that deals with the psychology to make it. Now you can still have fun doing it. You can do your thing. You can provide more answers to them than anybody else does in the group. That's cool. Okay? But you're helping me,
yes,
the introvert in this case, get my thing done as opposed to talking by me, you know?
Okay, I am here at Launch Street with Derek Kuhn, who is the president of Brility. Derek, you are the perfect person to have this conversation with. I want to talk to you about business growth because I suspect most of us are doing it wrong. I know I was. So how do you think about growth?
Hi. Hi, Tamara. So you're right. We have definitely seen some challenges how people think about growth. I think it boils down to this. They have these lofty aspirational goals, and then they have a bunch of disconnected plans and to-dos. The biggest thing I see, the biggest mistake they make is once they set these objectives and these aspirational goals, they need to spend some time thinking through and defining their strategy. And as we talk about strategy, it's an interlocking concepts that have compounding effect that are based on detailed research about your market opportunity, your company, your competitions, and then we form that, which allows us to be adaptive. So growth is mostly limited by the lack of a strategy, not for lack of goals and certainly not for lack of to-dos, but a thoughtful approach to the method behind the growth.
So, Derek, let me ask you this. When you say compounding effect, I mean, I know what that means, but how do you know if you have the right pieces that allow that to happen?
Well, that's a great question. And this is where our focus on digital platforms really delivers. In order to judge the effectiveness of your efforts, digital, unlike anything in the history of man, finally allows us to see in real time interactions, how things are being affected, the ripple effect, as well as the direct effect. And then we can adapt continually based on the feedback loop that we get.
All right, I'm going to go a little bit personal on Launch Street and on you, but I have to ask because I think I'm not the only one facing this. You know, one of the things I really over here at Launch Street struggle with growth is we've done all these elements to grow. The phone is ringing or, you know, the product is selling, whatever it is. The clients are coming. And then I realized, OMG, I have a delivery problem now. So I hit my growth. You'd probably call them goals. But I don't know, I don't have a strategy or I haven't figured out how to follow up. So how do you think about those two elements of kind of where you're trying to go and then delivering on that?
Yeah, well, let me tell you, first of all, that is a common challenge we see amongst our clients and is certainly that is what we call a good problem to have most of the time, right?
Yeah.
So, and it does come back to when we sit down and develop a strategy for our clients, scaling is included in growth. For example, if there are certain aspects of what you offer that have capacity, part of a good strategy is going to orient around those first. We prioritize those and then we sequence later growth over the long term. So it is definitely something to consider. And if you can build a strategy from the beginning, accounting for both growth and scaling, then that is the best way to handle that.
That's so fascinating. So what are the initial steps that you have clients take just kind of right out of the gate to better understand where they are versus where they're trying to go and what it's going to take to scale, to bridge that gap?
That's a great question. So I've been doing this for 15 years and developed a process specifically for what you just asked. We call it the Digital Presence Assessment, the DPA. And what that is, we will sit down with a client for about 15 minutes, 30 minutes tops, and get a sense of their objectives and their business goals. We then dig into all of the research and we go explore every possible opportunity, the current challenges in the digital space. And we assemble an assessment as to how to proceed, illustrating, in understandable terms, the different options that you have to help achieve your goal. And from that space, that assessment, the clients and us form a strategy together.
Now, if I'm out there in Launch Street listening and I want a part of this DPA, how do I do that?
Well, we would be happy to do that. We actually offer it for qualified clients only. We do this for free. This thing, we used to charge thousands of dollars for it. And in some cases, we still do a more elaborate one. But this really is self-serving to us because it helps us match up are the aspirations of the client possible to achieve through a thorough assessment. And for qualified clients, we do it absolutely free.
That's awesome. So I will, for Launch Street, I will put a link in the show notes to where you can learn more about that. Derek, always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I think you hit on something that I find to be really important, which is all around kind of the language of innovation. And in saying, can you help me with this? And structuring the exercise that way, you're allowing people to do what they do best and help you solve things, see things you didn't see, poke holes, fill those holes. I think oftentimes when we present our thinking, whether that's at this stage or later, we tend to force people into an up or down vote. Like, what do you think, right? Here it is. We think the idea is going to stand on its own. And they love it or hate it. And we're human. So most of the times we thumbs down it. But when you shift the conversation to how do you make this stronger? How can I help you? To your point, that's when you get the power of tapping all those minds in the room versus forcing people to love it or hate it like something they had for dinner.
And you keep thinking through psychology. So we built this ThinkStormer software for individuals. And, you know, if I talk to you in person, that can be one thing. But there's some cool academic research that shows that when two professors worked on a paper but were not at the same school, they actually got better papers. They got more citations because there's something about the written word that we can do. So I took that research and I said, oh, I wonder if we built this what we call idea doubling. So I put my basic idea down and some basic things. Who's the customer? What's the problem? What's the promise? What's the proof? Into some boxes. And then I can check three boxes and I can email to people to say, I'm looking for you to do idea doubling. You see what I've got here and this thing here. I'd love to have another way of thinking about it. And it's easy for people to just do that. And then I get back 10 different options for maybe the name of the thing or what the problem might be, you know, different things. And now I get to take that and to go build it as opposed to arm wrestling with a person in person about what's the right thing to do.
Right.
Which is just like, you know, shoot me, you know.
Right. Well, and it's personal and it doesn't work and it becomes an argument. And I just think we think the idea, you know, when we present it as kind of fully formed versus the language you're using, we don't allow people space to make it better.
Yeah. I mean, you could take the audience right now. You could take an idea you're working on, put it together. I mean, you can do it on the social media stuff or just email it to 10 people and say, 5 minutes of your time would help me a lot. Here's the idea I'm thinking about. Can you give me three ideas for making this better?
I'm not saying
I'm going to do them. Just give me three ideas. I'm open and I just want ideas, just anything that you want. It is amazing if you just ask for help. People so much want to help one another.
Yeah, and I love that idea. So for listeners, what a great thing to do at work with email, right? It takes 5 seconds to put that email together and send it out to people. Here's what I'm working on. Would love your ideas. Question for you. You didn't use the word feedback. Is that intentional or is that just take you down a different path?
Yeah, because that's a judgment. I'm looking for, in this case here, there's a time and a place for that. I tend to like quantitative, not qualitative. And in this case here, I'm looking for inspiration and ideas as opposed to feedback has a judgment dimension to it. And I'm looking for inspiration is what I'm looking for. Very perceptive. I'm catching that. But
well, it's
you even listen too. You don't only talk, you listen.
I mean, it turns out I've done a lot of work on my active listenings. I actually pay attention. and to kind of what you're saying, and I'm sure you've seen the research too. I have a colleague that wrote a book on kind of brain science, and you can't innovate and analyze at the same time. And I think you're right. And I hadn't really thought about it until you said it, that feedback puts you into analysis immediately without even realizing it. So that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that.
And there's a lot of psychology. So when we are at the point where we're working the ideas, one of the things that we find is a lot of this is psychology is what we're dealing with, is that we created this concept. So if I come to you with an idea and you look at it and you go, well, that's not going to work because of this. Immediately we've created a we, they. Mm. Instead, what we teach is for people to say there could be a death threat. So what I'm saying is, you know, it's an interesting idea, but there could be a death threat to this thing, which almost creates a third being that instead of you attacking me, we've said there could be this other thing off to the side, this death threat to this idea. It might not be able to make the math work or whatever it is. Now we can both together look to problem solve the death threat as opposed to it becoming a personal attack on my judgment.
Right. And that is, I'll just say the language that you're using, I think is a really powerful shift. It truly shifts the outcomes of innovation, I think, in something so, I don't want to say basic, but it's, I think we take for granted kind of the language that we use and we don't think about the impact of it.
You're very true.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question about meaningfully unique innovation. And, you know, you're part of Eureka Ranch, which I'm just going to own this to you. Back in the days when I was working in a couple innovation firms, we lost out to you a few times. So when your name came across my desk, I was like, hey, I know that name.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. I mean, look, that was the game we were all in, right? So, it's all good. But I laughed a little bit when I got your book and I read through it. I was like, I remember Eureka Ranch. But I would love a real world example of meaningfully unique innovation. And I know you talked in the beginning about like, it's got to be viable and shit, but share a story there because I know the work that you did is so powerful. I mean, I was up against it many times. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So first off, you have to have a definition. So rather than ask people how likely they're to buy it, we ask them how likely they're to buy it, how new and different it is. And then we weight it 60% purchase and 40% new. So there's a whole metric and a science to this, which is much more predictive. And I wrote a paper with Dr. Lynn Colley that talked about it that does that. But let me give you a simple example from some friends of ours up in Canada. You know, they're in the fish business. They sell frozen fish. And the problem with frozen fish with millennials is, right?
Yeah. That can't be good.
Yeah. So that's not going to be good. Truth is actually frozen fish is actually healthier because most of the fresh fish was frozen anyways, and they've slacked it out. And it's safer usually and a whole bunch of things. But that aside, so we needed a way. And then you start to look at millennials and you realize they can't cook. They've not cooked. The home economics classes are gone and cooking fish. They'll eat fish out more than they'll eat it at home, no matter what type it is, because they overcook it and it becomes tough and rest of stuff.
So the question is,
How could you make it, I mean, to be meaningfully unique, you need to be able to make me something that was like in 10 minutes, amazing, that I couldn't screw up, right? And so we invented this whole process called reverse sous vide, where you boil water. So now we know the temperature. It's basically a thermodynamics equation. You take the fish, which is in a bag, you put it in, and then you turn the temperature off and you put a cover on it. And 10 minutes later, you come back. And if you have two drinks and it becomes 20 minutes or 30 minutes, it's still absolutely perfect fish. And the name of it is Can't Mess It Up. Mm. Can't Mess It Up. And so you've got the synergy of a technology, a product, a problem that people have. And literally in 10 minutes, you can have yourself perfect. I mean, literally restaurant quality fish. And it, the fish has got little cuts in it to make the heat go through. And there's a whole bunch of science that makes the thing actually work, but which nobody cares about. But that's a matter of a product where when I can get gourmet fish cooked perfectly in 10 minutes that I can't mess up, that's meaningfully unique.
And the thing that intrigues me about that story and that example is that it's a wonderful combination of data and science, as you've talked about, that make that possible, and customer insight and layering those two together. Will you talk a little bit about the importance of that? Because I do think sometimes we can get too skewed one way or the other.
Yeah. So to me, the concept of customer insights was created by Ross Love at Procter & Gamble. That's the guy who invented it. And he said, but it got out of control. And he was a mentor of mine, and he's since passed, bless him. But I talked with him and I said, Ross, my problem with insights is sometimes the insights are the sky is blue. And I'm like, why do I care? He says, I was just trying to get agencies. He was head of the American Association of Agencies at the time to get some clarity and focus the thing. I said, Ross, I've changed it to problem. What's the customer's problem? Oh, he says, that's much sharper. That's much sharper. In other words, what is their problem that they've got?
What do they need help with?
Yeah. What is the problem that we're solving? And now, interestingly, as time's gone on, we've also found that there are problems they're aware of. And then another, the problems that they don't have, we call wishes. What are the things they don't even know are possible?
Yeah.
That they don't even know is possible. And sure enough, what we're finding is, it's like the idea of making a whiskey with 200 year wood, the time of the riverboat, you're never going to ask for that. I really wish I could have an old
if
whiskey.
Only. You know.
Yeah. So you've got a game here you got to play in that customer problems are a good foundation. But if you're not careful, you're just reactive. It's your job. It's like Deming said, nobody asked for a fax machine. Nobody asked for one. Somebody had the imagination to create it. And so we have to balance out what their problems are with being proactive and imagining the future, which is what the future mining and a lot of stuff I talk about in the book is about how do we anticipate the future? How do we do those things? Because, and again, if you don't understand the whole, the consumer where they are today, the technology of what's possible, the economics of how does the math get made in this thing. That's why entrepreneurs have such an advantage over big corporations because the entrepreneur has to do all of that math in their head.
Yeah, yeah.
Corporations have silos to do each one of those things. And so collectively, they're stupid.
Right, right.
You know, versus being able to have it all in your own head.
Two thoughts. One is, it always makes me laugh because I think to your point about kind of solving yesterday's problems, which is what focus groups lead to in a lot of ways, I think. And I think if you had, you know, I'm going to venture to say that if we had taken the iPad into a focus group way back in the day and said, do you need this thing? It's smaller than your computer and it doesn't do what your computer does. And it's bigger than your phone, but you can't make phone calls. I can't imagine someone would have said, yes, that sounds like a great idea, right? So kind of to your point about being future driven, I think that's kind of an obvious example. Now we can't live without it. The other thing that you're kind of, what you were saying made me think is I had this moment, this was years ago now, because I don't know if I call myself an old fart, but I'd say I've been around the block a few times. And one of the experiences I had was we were in front of one of our CPG clients, you know, major Fortune 500 company. This was, you know, you've been in this position, right? It's like those $500,000 projects of create the new line, you know, new product line, change the future for us. And I'll never forget my team was up there presenting with their PowerPoint with all these bullets of what they would call insights. But what I really came to realize fast in that meeting was, to your point about the sky is blue, they weren't sharing insights or what to do with it. They were sharing information. And they hadn't actually taken it to a place that made it actionable. And I was so frustrated because I left that meeting realizing, so what? So what if the sky is blue? What do you want me to do with that? And I don't know if you ever run into that kind of difference between here's the data versus here's what the data actually tells us and what you can do with it. Like, how do you bridge that or elevate that thinking?
Well, to me, it almost is as simple as boring, you know. Mm. If when they're presenting the insights, it's boring, if it isn't unexpected, if it isn't surprising, if it isn't news, it's never going to be news. It's just going to be expensive production values.
Mm. That's a great way to think
of it. You've got to fundamentally have something that, you know, where's the news? Because if you want to get social media, I mean, it all connects together. I mean, we've been doing a lot of track on social media on diffusion of innovations. And it's like most ideas aren't even unique enough to matter. They just don't matter.
Yeah.
And so the threshold, what, you know, years ago, what we would have as a success standard is now about 2 standard deviations too low.
Yeah,
if you want to be successful in the marketplace. The problem is you got to change and you don't have enough marketing money to make it work. So you have to change the way you're creating ideas. They have to be bigger, bolder, which means it can't just be marketing spin thrown over the head, over the wall to the product of them. You need to work together. You need to work together to invent the future, to invent the next thing and get the patents and the rest of that stuff. The days when we could do those simple little line extensions, you know, back in the old days, you know, you could do a little line extension. You could spend $10 million, get 50% of households aware of the thing and make yourself $20 million. It was easy. Now, you're not even in the game. Nobody cares.
Right, right.
You're boring. It's just plain boring.
And frankly, there's so many choices that nobody's even paying attention anymore. So even if they see it, it's like, I mean, I don't know. I try not to go to the grocery store. I do everything by delivery. But every now and again, I actually love it. I could explore the grocery store all day and new products because I love it. It's my background. But if you ever go down the cereal aisle, it's like, oh my God, how much money are these guys spending on, you know, 1% more fiber or a shift in cinnamon and whatever, paprika, who the knows? I mean, it's just so overwhelming for people.
Well, and you know, the result of that is 95% of the new ones fail.
Right. Right. And then they just replace it with something else.
Well, and the thing that kills me is people will sit in meetings and they'll say, well, look what they're doing. We should do something like that.
Right.
I said, they're losers.
Right.
Okay. They're losers. Why would I want to do what the losers are doing? You know, let's change what we're doing. Now, the problem is that, you know, it's like this meeting. They said, we're no dumber than anybody else. That's right. You're just as stupid.
Right.
You know,
way to hit the bar low. Jeez.
Are you wasting your life? Let's do something that matters. I mean, let's do stuff that matters.
Can you invite me?
And that's where I get to the point after all these years. That it's like, if you want to do really cool things, you want to make an amazing breakthrough, no problem. We can do that.
We can
teach you how to do it.
Can you please invite me to one of your meetings where you tell them that everybody else are losers? Why would you be like losers? Because I really would like to hear you say that to a group of people. Like, I really want to see their reaction to it.
It happens.
I bet it was. I will be on the next plane. You let me know. But I'm 100% with you. I mean, I would just very quickly take one of my favorite examples, which is Dollar Shave Club. Like, way to flip it on its head, the industry and the distribution model, not the product, but the distribution model. But, you know, everybody else in the razor business was doing exactly what you're saying. And just one more blade, titanium, steel, lubricant, whatever. And it took someone to go, we're going to think totally differently about this and make it more meaningful for people to actually make a dent. And I think that's ultimately what it takes.
Yeah. I mean, it takes somebody with some courage and to do some experiments. But entrepreneurs rarely gamble. And the people that really do this, you know, run little tests. They get data. They don't just gamble. They don't just take moonshots. They run a lot of experiments along the way, and some of them are qualitative, some of them are quantitative, but they're getting that feedback in and getting smarter about it. And so by the time they do it, it's not a big risk.
Yeah, you know, so a colleague asked me for coffee the other day. They were trying to launch a portion of their business that I've already done. And they said, well, how did you do it? And I was telling them they'd created all their materials. They were like, go to market. And I said, actually, I would back up. What I still do actually is I said, you know, when I launch a new revenue stream for my business or I have a new service or a new product, whatever it is, I create a web page or a marketing page, something, and then I call up everybody I know to get feedback on it, to get their perspective on it and to see if it's something they'd be interested in. And then I do it again, and then I go back to them and then I do it again. So by the time I launch, I've actually experimented dozens of times before I'm putting that out into market.
Absolutely.
And the person was shocked. They're like, really? You don't just launch? Like, you don't know what you're talking about? And I was like, of course I don't know what I'm talking about. This is my language and my lingo. I got to ask them what they think.
Yeah, but the egos, see, the egos are so big. I mean, that's why I force teams, you know, we push them. We do these accelerators in 3.5 days where we compress a bunch of time. And I say, okay, 2:00, we're going to quantitative tests. They go, no, we won't be ready. I said, too bad.
Yeah, you will.
Screw
you.
We're going. And of course, so the idea is crappy and it dies. I said, good, we didn't waste any more time on it. It wasn't a good idea to begin with. Okay, let's do it again.
Yeah.
And we do it again. And we do it again. And we set these things up. We can run 400 quantitative tests in 3.5 days. It is mind-blowing. The technology that exists today is so amazing of the speed that we can go. I mean, you know, that's why I say in the book, increase speed up to a factor of 6 and decrease risk by 80%. I actually had to tamper the numbers down because it was going to be too incredible, the true numbers on it, because the existing system is so crappy. Of course it fails.
Yeah.
Of course it fails.
We set it up to fail. And I think, and I'm venturing to say you'd agree, but tell me if you don't, that I think we need to decouple being bold, like, you know, doing something kind of really bold and ultimately meaningful, unique, and being risky, because they're not actually the same thing. But I think people put them together.
I agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree. We, you know, I'm not interested in great leaps of faith.
Yeah.
That's gambling.
Yep.
That's
agreed.
Just gambling. And that's just stupid. You know, we can measure. There's nothing that we can't measure, that we can gather information on, and we can gather data to make us smarter, and we can do it fast and cheap if we have the right systems. If we have the right systems, and that's the key, and that's why the software that we do and that kind of stuff. It's about, and other people have things, but you know, you need tools. And it's not the same. The world's changed when it comes to innovation.
Well, and to your point in the very beginning, you need tools that allow for that uncertainty too, and to test the uncertainty, not just strip it out of it or try to minimize it, because it does exist. I know we're running out of time. So before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn more and connect? And if you wouldn't mind sharing that, the software you built too, kind of where that is, because I think people want to know.
Yeah. So if you go to eurekaranch.com, that's the place where you can find about all of the different software. So IdeaStormer's there, and there's also a Trailblazer system for groups, for teams to be able to do it. And go to Eureka Ranch for that. And so eurekaranch.com is the best place to go. To find out about some of my stuff, let's do a special offer for your folks there. Is if you go to Doug Hall, D-O-U-G-H-A-L-L, DougHall.com/VIP. So DougHall.com/VIP. If you go in there and sign up, I've got a newsletter and podcast and stuff that goes out. But the important thing is that I've got a 1-hour audiobook summary that you can download. There's a 10-hour full audiobook that you can get on all the platforms. But there's a 1-hour summary that you can get. And I've also got – and I loved your assessment. I thought it was cool. In fact, I think you'd like – the one we've got there is built off of our teams, because we've measured teams for a long time. It's a different purpose than yours. But I thought that was wonderful to do that, by the way. That was kudos.
Well,
that
you're,
was cool.
I love hearing you talk, by the way. I'm just going to say real quick. You're a futuristic inquisitive, and your constant drive to like the wish, the future, and the questioning just totally – I loved hearing it, because I was like, oh my God, he totally is that. That's great. So keep going.
And so this one helps identify your strengths, weaknesses, and then it gives you an automated assessment that gives you suggestions on how to build on your strengths and how to get better. So it's nobody fails the test. Everybody, it gives you a personal diagnosis, totally private. It's based off of, I don't know, about 200,000 people we've got in the database. It's a gargantuanly ridiculous database. And it can give you that and you can get the audio. So you can get started. And by the way, if you go and you do that right now, an hour from now, you would be smarter than you are now.
And how awesome is that?
It takes nothing to do that. That's a concept.
I like it. It's a little bit of that growth mindset, right? All right. So last question, and I'll put all those links in the show notes, by the way. What's the first step we can take to drive eurekas in our work?
So we've got an irreverent statement that the students on campus have called innovation engineering, because we teach it on campus, of course, and they say it's all about doing cool shit that matters. And I will tell you, I think what we've got to do is we've got to stop doing stuff that doesn't matter in our life. We've got to take a stand for our lives. We've got to decide that we're going to do meaningful stuff. And we're going around the bend for the same stupid thing. We've got to say, I'm done. Let's start now doing stuff that matters.
I so appreciate that. And I think when you start getting into that mindset, the work that you do becomes more meaningful naturally. Like, you can't help it because you've just decided your life is going to mean more.
And energy. You know, everybody's out of energy. They're tired. You suddenly have a vitality of energy that is endless energy when you're doing stuff that matters in life. In my life, over these many, many years that I've been doing this, it's all about doing meaningful stuff. And as long as I do meaningful stuff, I'm on the right path. Things are wonderful for clients. That's why I speak truth to power. And they know, they go, I retired as CEO and I just do inventing for the teams now. They bring me in to create ideas. And they know I'm going to speak truth, not to be mean, not to be this, but to just say that. And it is so liberating. And so many people appreciate it because we spend so much time worrying about what other people are thinking instead of just being integrity to ourselves that we're doing something that matters.
You know, it's this is a little bit on a personal note, but since kind of you went there, one of the stickies on my screen says, how do I add value to this person? So I always try to remember that as I go into meetings, podcast interviews, whatever. And what it allowed me to do, that frame of reference, that question, how do I add value to this person, is it freed me up to not worry about what they thought, but position and to come to the situation with a mindset of, I will say what I need to say, what I think is the truth they need to hear. And of course, it's done with, you know, authenticity and love. I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad, but that has really upped my business and my game in a way that was kind of surprising by that one little question.
I it's amazing when it comes to innovations. It is rare when something fails and you're talking to the people later that they can't point to the time they figured out that it wasn't going to work.
Right. And they kept it to themselves,
it's not just rewriting history, because they can literally pull a document out or they can pull a chart out. And this was the moment I knew. And then you say, well, why didn't you say anything? They said, well, we'd spent so much time on it. I figured it was better than
everybody
nothing.
Else liked it. So I figured I was missing something.
And all of them, when you go around and you meet them one-on-one, they're like, It's like, so how much, it just sucks the life out of you when you're working on something that you know it's not going to work. And we've got to say no to that. That's why I love millennials. My baby boomer generation, we all do this all the time. But the millennials are much more common to say, I'm out of here, baby. This is, you know, this is a waste of time. And I think that is brilliant. And I hope they I mean, in the 60s, we used to be like that when we were hippies before we checked out and sold out. But they, you know, they really, there's just something wonderful about that.
I love it.
Don't tell me you need to understand. You need to learn. No, I don't need to learn. It's stupid.
I have a 14-year-old son, and I can't remember what we were talking about, but some rule came up, and he goes, well, I'm not going to follow that. That's just dumb. And I was like, kudos. Good for you, buddy.
Is it a guidance or a rule?
Yeah. Well, and frankly, there are rules that just shouldn't be, right? They're just – I'm not saying don't stay on your side of the road, but there are others where you think, really? How does that help anybody? But anyway, Doug, thank you for coming by. This was a real treat. And it really was nice to talk to somebody who I used to lose to occasionally.
Well, wonderful. And thank you so much for all you're doing and keep doing it.
That was fantastic, wasn't it? Yeah. Doug is full of incredible experience. And I just kind of love his brass tacks way of looking at things and looking at data. I think sometimes we think data and innovation are mutually exclusive, but I know he knows, hopefully you know, they're not. They really, one can lead to the other. So here's what I want you to do before you go. Just do me this favor. Click on the link in the show notes and go to Brility's offer of a digital assessment. You will not regret it for your business, big or small. They work with major Fortune 1000 companies and small guys like us. All right, Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.